WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything that's in the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. And welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for April the 1st, 2018. A happy Easter to all of you who are celebrating. Also, beware of April Fool's Day. Thank you for joining us on our weekly look at the world of politics and policy. We'll take you from City Hall to Springfield all the way out to Washington, D.C. So, yes, it's time to grab that Sunday paper, get that hot cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to get your week off to a great start. Well, quite a run by the Loyola Ramblers. I mean, what can you say? An exciting game. And hand it to Michigan that when it came down to crunch time, they were the more poised team. But Andy, like I was saying, I was worried about turnovers.
Yep.
And that's what did them in.
Yeah, this is not a team that really turns the ball over all that much. And it just seemed like it kind of snowballed after, I think it was four straight possessions ended in a turnover, which again is very uncharacteristic of this team. And I'm not sure if that, snowballed or affected confidence, because it's been a very confident basketball team
right
from the very beginning of the season. But you know how that things go. I mean, one bad thing leads to the next bad thing, and you try to do too much the next time down the floor, and bad things happen. But again, you're right. Michigan had the answer. The Michigan was down 10 points and came back and was able to win. So you begrudgingly tip your hat to them and kind of recall what a great season. 32-6 is nothing to sneeze at.
Oh no! And speaking of tipping the hat, I'm wearing my Loyola hat today.
Nice.
In their honor, and it's a well deserved honor. It was, I mean, just a great thing for the city. Just an uplifting, unifying season.
Yeah.
And you know, in these goofy times we're in, anytime you can find something to unify and rally behind, I mean, what can you say about the Ramblers? And looking forward to next season.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking last night about, you know, tweeting, and what I finally decided to tweet was just a big thank you. I mean, that's really kind of, I think that's really what the sentiments of the city is, as you pointed out. I mean, it was a real rallying thing, and everybody jumped on board. I don't think they were very upset at all with people just jumping on the bandwagon.
I was one.
Yeah.
I jumped on the bandwagon.
You know, a lot of times you hear that, well, where have you been all year? Those kind of things, you know, but you didn't hear much of that because it was just, the way they went about it was just all correct.
Mm-hmm.
Kids were great throughout the whole tournament. It's you know, now you kind of wonder, or you don't wonder, but now you see why Porter Moser is exactly the right coach for this team. I think they handled everything with class, winning with class, and they lost with class.
And don't forget Sister Jean.
Sister Jean she's an international sensation.
Exactly.
I saw more stories about her on network newscasts.
How about
and it? Our what we get in here through ABC Radio News the past few weeks, there's been something on Sister Jean. It really has. It's been terrific.
Well, yeah.
Not to mention the song
that came out. Right. Well, you had the Ramblers going, and then. How about Scott Foster? what a great story. And I'm interested.
That was another network story I saw.
Well, and I'm surprised because a lot of people don't know about the I mean, this is like a decades long rule about the emergency backup goalie.
Right.
And I remember, I think it might have been last year when the Hawks.
Yeah, in Philadelphia.
Yes, I knew it was either Pittsburgh or Philadelphia but he only sat. He dressed.
He didn't play. He sat. I remember Coach Q was talking about putting him in.
Yeah, right. At the
late
end
in the game,
or something.
But didn't do it.
Well, and I didn't realize what was happening when I saw that the starting goalie, our starting goalie, went down, and I kept waiting to see who was going to come out of the tunnel, you know, and here it comes 36-year-old Scott Foster.
The accountant.
The accountant from Oak Park, and a mainstay at Johnny's Ice House.
Yeah, did you hear you know all about that rule? I mean, it's a really interesting rule. I don't know how many fans realize that they get a guy to come in, And he could play for either team.
Right, correct.
So he's not linked just to the Blackhawks. They sign him to what they call an amateur tryout. So there's no money involved with it. It's just the prestige of being able to think about playing. Usually what happens is the guy goes up to the press box and never sees the bench, never sees the dressing room, never sees anything. But, you know, with the Hawks losing Anton Forsberg during warm-ups, he was kind of in the, he was hanging around the locker room and was near his gear, because when Colin Delia went down with the cramps late in the game, that's when they had to call him in.
Yeah, and but see, like with what happened in Philadelphia last time, I don't know that they regularly seat somebody, that all the teams do that like they do with the Blackhawks, of having somebody, you know, standing by in the press box or something like that, because I think they had to actually call the backup. The Philadelphia team called the backup in, and I think he was like an assistant coach or something.
Yeah, he was an assistant. I think that was the one that when Corey Crawford may have gone through the appendix surgery. I think that's what that was last year when that happened with the young man that came in. I can't remember his name. How about that? I can't remember.
I know.
But I think we're going to remember Scott Foster's name for a while. Just the fact that the post-game interviews were about the funniest thing I've ever seen.
Well, and you knew he was going to be the number one star in the game, too. That was just an automatic. And when you've got the United Center crowd chanting, Foster, Foster.
Yeah, how about that?
I mean, that's just a lifetime moment. I mean, what can you say? And granted, he doesn't get paid, but you can bet that sweater with his name on it's going to be hanging prominently in his home.
Yeah, I think he'll wear that not even only on Halloween. He probably wore it to bed that night.
Oh, you gotta think. So I mean, like, his experience other than Johnny's Ice House was he played for Western Michigan University, and where he had 0.875 save percentage there. I think he was like 20-22 or something in games played there. But just a fantastic story. Just a fantastic story. And of course, after the game, he had the great comment where, I think I'm just about hitting my prime.
Hitting my prime. That was unbelievable. He handled it really well. I mean, you could tell he was a little nervous, and I don't blame him, because he's not used to dealing with that as an accountant. You don't see too many microphones.
No.
Unless there's something going on with an audit or something like that. You know,
there isn't a real avid press corps at the accountant's office.
No, not usually, but I thought he did a nice job, and you know, why not soak it up? I mean, that might be the last, you know, it's obviously probably going to be the last time that ever happens to this guy.
Right, exactly. And I would just love to be back at Johnny's Ice House when he's back playing his next game out there, and see what the kind of the reaction he gets from his friends and teammates over there. I mean, there has to be a lot of good-natured razzing going on. That's for
you would think.
Yeah, that's for sure. And thank goodness we got baseball back.
How about that, huh?
Yeah. You know, that I watched the Sox opener, and so you get Shields pitching and gives up four runs without even getting an out.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, man.
Here we go.
Yeah. And kaboom, he spends the next five innings or so, shuts them down, and the Sox take off.
Yeah, the offense was incredible, you know, on a less than stellar day to hit.
Right, but how many home runs that day?
Six home runs.
Yeah, that's all.
Counting, yeah. Yeah. Six home runs, three from Matt Davidson.
Where did he come from?
He had 26 home runs last year. I mean, a young guy that basically came into the season hoping to get a chance to play in the field, but also hoping to cut down on strikeouts and also increase his walks. And he said after the game the other day that, yeah, the three homers were great. He was more impressed with the walk that he took after the three home run game. And I think that was very well received by the manager, Ricky Renteria, and also by the general manager, Rick Hahn. So, yeah, I mean, and they came back and they won a game last night that they probably shouldn't have won.
Right. I mean, that's what's going to be fun about watching them this year, is that kind of don't count them out.
No, I mean, the rallying cry last year was Ricky's boys play hard, and, you know, and they don't quit. So that's kind of, I think that mantra has extended to this season. And, you know, you're getting a chance to see some of this very young talent, Yoan Moncada, with a home run. I think that might still be going to start the eighth inning last night. And then, you know, you have a little mix of veterans with the former Cubs catcher Wellington Castillo coming through with the big hit last night.
Well, and never giving up, that's the case on the north side as well.
True. I mean, they have played 27 innings of baseball in the last 2 days.
Yeah, yes.
A tough one to lose 17 innings the night before, scoring just one run, and they score 10 last night in 10 innings, and Ben Zobrist, the hero of the World Series, came through with the go-ahead run in the top of the 10th.
Yeah, a four-run 10th inning. I mean, that's what took you so long.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think Schwarbs also hit one that may still be going.
Yeah, he went into the upper deck in Miami, and I'm not sure if you've ever been to that stadium, but it's not an easy place to hit the ball up into that area where he did. So I think the people that were wondering if the slimmed down version of Kyle Schwarber lost any power, I don't think he did.
No, not at all. Not at all. He just crushed it. Just crushed it. I hope there aren't going to be any April Fool's Day pranks here around the studio today.
I hope not either. I've got my eye on Schwani.
Just getting started.
I've got my eye on you, Schwani.
Wow, that sounded like a real warning cry, didn't it? The show is just getting started.
The show is young.
Oh, man. Thanks, Dave. I really appreciate the threat already this early in the morning. Oh, man. It's so much fun to come to work on Sunday mornings with you guys.
That's why they call me Sunshine Schwani.
Yeah, well, they call you other things, too, but we can't use them on the radio.
You can't say that.
Yeah, exactly.
It would be foolish to do so.
Well, Dave's here to keep us up on all the news. Andy's got the latest sports. Producer Cassera's here to field your phone calls. We're at 312-981-7200. You can also text us at 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter at @SymbolSundaySpin. Engineer Bob is roaming the studio looking for his Easter eggs. Remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNradio.com. You can also get our podcasts at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, after we catch up on the news and sports at 7:30, we'll speak with Democratic State Representative Rob Martwick of Chicago, and we'll talk to him about ways to deal with the state's pension debt, push for an elected school board in Chicago, as well as all of that talk about a graduated income tax. After the news at 8, we'll speak to Maria Creason. She's a professor of sociology at the University of Illinois, Chicago. She's also the co-author of a new book called Cycle of Segregation, about how our living experiences really shape us and how we choose where or where not to live. We'll have some more news and sports at 8:30, and then I'll feature some highlights of my recent conversation with Illinois Supreme Court Justices Ann Burke and Rita Garman at Aurora University last week. A very informative discussion. Back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. It's time for our weekly spin through national politics. President Trump, as we all know, loves to tweet, but one thing he hasn't tweeted about was last Sunday's 60-minute broadcast featuring an interview with the porn star, producer, and director known as Stormy Daniels. But there could be some legal ramifications over the issue of hush money allegedly paid to her days before the 2016 election. Trump made his first high-profile appearance of the week in Richfield, Ohio on Thursday night, where he delivered a meandering speech for what was supposed to be a rally on infrastructure. There was one piece of infrastructure he did talk about, the border wall with Mexico. He all but accused Democrats of supporting drugs crossing the border.
We didn't have one Democrat who voted for that. They want to raise your taxes, and they want people to come in from the border, and they want, I guess, want. I can't imagine they want. But certainly drugs are flowing across borders. We need walls. We started building our wall. I'm so proud of it. We have 1.6 billion. And we've already started. You saw the pictures yesterday. I said, what a thing of beauty. And on September 28th, we go further. And we're getting that sucker built. And you think that's easy? People said, oh, has he given up on the wall?
No, I never give up.
We have 1.6 billion toward the wall.
Look at the ride the student body.
And we've done the planning.
Look at the ride the alumni went on.
And you saw those beautiful
pictures. Look at the perception of people looking at what they did and how they did it. I mean, leaving an impact like that.
Not exactly sure what kind of crosstalk we got over there, but that was the president speaking in Ohio. Can we go to the next? Okay, so Trump talked about a wide variety of issues with no concrete plans in place yet to speak with the North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un. Trump still said that tensions with North Korea have been reduced.
We're moving along very nicely with North Korea. We'll see what happens. Certainly the rhetoric has calmed down just a little bit. Would you say? Would you say? And we'll see how it all turns out. Maybe it'll be good and maybe it won't. And if it's no good, we're walking. And if it's good, we will embrace it. But it's going to be very interesting over the next period of time.
Now, with continued calls for combating gun violence, former Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens, a Chicago native, called for abolishing the Second Amendment. Now, that's very highly, highly unlikely. But Trump won praise when he vowed that the Second Amendment is safe while he's around. And he replied when an audience member shouted out that abolishing the Second Amendment would amount to tyranny.
We want to protect our Second Amendment. You saw the other day. We're a very important... We're a very important... And respected in some circles, Democrat, said we should get rid of our Second Amendment. In other words, get rid of it. That's really, could be right about that. So we're going to protect our Second Amendment. That's not going to happen.
So also speaking about issues involving guns and gun violence, classic rocker and NRA board member Ted Nugent has attacked Parkland's high school teenage school shooting survivors, calling them mushy-brained and soulless liars. To attack the good law-abiding families of America when well-known predictable murderers commit these horrors is deep in the category of soulness. Of soulless. These poor children, I'm afraid to say this, and it hurts me to say this, but the evidence is irrefutable. They have no soul, he said. This is Ted Nugent, I guess still looking to try to be relevant after so many, many years. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning. Happy Easter. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. Last week, we learned a bit about the president's mindset when it comes to education. President Trump in Ohio says that community colleges shouldn't be called community colleges. They should be called vocational schools, even though, as far as I know, they do a lot more than just vocational training. Here's the president.
A word that you don't hear much, but when I was growing up, we had what was called vocational schools. They weren't called community colleges, because I don't know what that means, a community college. To me, it means a two-year college. I don't know what it means. But I know what vocational, and I tell people, call it vocational from now on. It's a great word. It's a great word. Call it vocational and technical, perhaps. But use vocational, because that's what it's all about. People know what that means. We don't know what a community college means.
Vocational is a great word. Just remember that today. Well, joining me here in the Allstate Showcase studio in historic Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue is Democratic State Representative Robert Martwick from Chicago. Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thanks for having me. Happy Easter to you and all your listeners.
Thank you. I wanted to talk to you about a variety of things, because somehow you always seem to be in the middle of a variety of things.
I tend to do that, yeah.
But first, I wanted to ask you about the issue of a graduated income tax. And obviously, that was frankly, it was supported by every candidate for governor on the Democratic side of having a income tax, not that's the flat rate that we have now, but a personal income tax rate that's on a sliding scale based on income.
Right.
And I know that you introduced legislation effectively creating a that kind of a graduated income tax.
I did. In fact, it's gotten some attention lately, but the genesis of this is that this was developed during the heart of the budget impasse. So we're talking late 2016, and it was filed in January of 2017. So a year and a half ago, we filed that legislation. And it was a way of, when we were sitting there at that budget impasse bleeding red ink, it was a way of mathematically looking at our financial problems and trying to figure out a way to restructure our entire system of taxation and spending to make us more efficient. So that's what that was designed to do.
And this grew attention from a group of critics.
Yeah, recently it's gained a lot of attention from a group called the Illinois Policy Institute, which, you know, they like to portray themselves as an independent think tank, but anyone who really understands them knows that they come with a great deal of bias. So their chief economist, which I love, he's, you know, he gets to put that PhD at the end of his name, did an economic analysis of my bill, talking about the negative aspect of a tax increase. Well, any tax increase is going to have some sort of negative economic benefit, but one of the things that he failed to notice, and I have a hard time believing that a PhD would just miss this in the bill, is that my bill, as I said, it's a restructuring, so it comes with historic tax decreases. We always talk in Illinois about how high our property taxes are and how unfriendly we are as a state to business. My bill was attempting to restructure the system by replacing our flat tax with a graduated income tax, excuse me, and then using that to offset high property taxes. So there would be historic property tax reductions statewide and a sales tax decrease, which of course would have very positive economic benefit. But of course he seemed to miss that. So
I'm curious, even though, as you said, this came about during the midst of the historic budget impasse, but knowing Governor Rauner, a legislation like this, you know, one, you have the constitutional issues.
Yeah.
But the fact that this isn't even, Rauner would never sign this.
No, and again, when we were in the budget.
Is it more for an economic exercise? Really?
It's a mathematical exercise to me. I've never looked at our problems in a vacuum on today's date. That's the problem that we've had in Illinois for decades, is everyone says, how do we solve whatever is bothering us today and we'll worry about tomorrow when tomorrow gets here. I looked at this over the course of the next 27 years. And I picked 27 because that's the extent of our pension ramp that we're under.
Mm-hmm.
And when I asked, so we have a state version of the Congressional Budget Office. We call it COGFA, the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability. Nonpartisan economists, number crunchers. We give them a problem, they give us an answer. And so I work with them quite a bit asking these questions. And if we look at where we're headed, right? So if we make our pension payments as required, and we know that that's essential to do, if we live up to the commitment that we just celebrated, this commitment for education funding, where we're going to increase funding over education, and we allow all the rest of the spending just to grow at historical levels, which in Illinois is not bad because we've had a lot of cuts lately, we're going to fall $225 billion short over the next 27 years. According to COGFA, if we were to put in a flat tax today, what flat tax level would we need to make sure that we don't continue to accumulate debt, that we meet all of our requirements over the next 27 years? It would be 6.45% flat. Well, that's, I would agree with anybody that that's not the right way to go about it. And so knowing that we've got this massive shortfall, we have to find ways to get ahead of it. And because otherwise we're going to be in a really, really bad situation. And again, you think about that. That's 6.45% is what it needs to be today. If we're to balance the budget over the next 27 years, if we don't do that today, by the time we get down the road, you're talking 7.5-8% flat income tax, because it'll have to rise even more.
And that's not addressing the property tax issue.
No, it would have no effect on property taxes whatsoever. And so what I did was I said, let's put in a graduated income tax, let's raise revenue now and use that money to pay down, to start investing and restructuring. So lowering property taxes would be a big boom for our our whole economy. One of the things I did with that money, in addition to, you know, everyone talks about the increase. It's not about the increase. It's what you do with it that matters. And so I put $1 billion a year extra into the pension payment. And that's like, you know, that's like putting in more than your minimum payment on your credit card. It tends to reduce your balance. And if we put in $1 billion a year additional above what we're required to do over the next 27 years, we will save the state $121 billion, right? So these are the sorts of things where it's like we can solve our problems, but if we just keep going along day to day trying to keep everything as minimal as possible, not only will we not solve the problems, they'll be untenable down the road. And, you know, I've got an 18-month-old son, and in 27 years, I don't want to leave a bankrupt state for him.
Well, and as you say, it's kind of the short-term thinking that, yeah, that this legislature, and I would say most legislatures, they tend to be reactionary to crises, not in a forward-looking kind of body.
Right. That's what this exercise was. I never thought that this would be, that everyone would suddenly say hurrah and pass my bill and the governor would sign it and we'd all hold a celebration. But it was designed to put something out there because we just don't have anything out there. We just creep along from day to day saying, oh my God, well, how much are we short? What should we cut? Oh my gosh, do we need to raise taxes? How much? And this was a way of saying, let's project out 27 years and let's put the reforms, really, spending reforms, taxation reforms up front, and use that money to solve problems.
I'm curious your thoughts, because, as I said, with the fact that you had all of the major Democratic candidates for governor in support of a graduated income tax, and in the past we've seen where it's been proposed in Springfield, but one of the problems was that it's easy to attack because it would be as a constitutional amendment that wouldn't mandate the rates.
Right.
And I know a couple of candidates suggested that there actually be legislation to establish the rates.
Right.
So that perhaps might make it easier to pass a constitutional amendment.
Well, and I think that's important. I've seen all sorts of different rate structures when you have, again, they don't have to be, when they say graduated income tax rates, there was a proposal last year where the rates were 3, 3.75, 8.75, and 9.75. I said, that's not graduated, right? I've heard other proposals where people say, oh, you know what we'll do? We'll propose a rate structure that will lower taxes on 95% of Illinoisans, which, I mean, that sounds wonderful. That sounds great. But again, you can't lower property taxes unless you're offsetting that money, right? So my way of doing it was saying, look, if what I picked five problems that we have in Illinois: underfunding education, high property taxes, a business unfriendly environment, high debt, and massive year after year cuts to programs that actually are designed to save us money. But we're so short of money that we're cutting programs that save us money, if that makes any sense at all. And so I said, if I put in a progressive income tax structure, and I said, let me actually show the rates, and I, the rates I used, which again, this wasn't mentioned in the critique of my plan, there was a reason that I used them. They're the rates from the state of Wisconsin, right? We're always told we should be more like Wisconsin, a red state, a red legislature, and they're not looking to get rid of these rates. They are smooth, they're predictable, they're fair, they make sense. But then you raise the money and you invest into the things that matter, so that you can restructure our system, lower property taxes, lower sales taxes, pay down debt, and actually put the state in a position. And here's the kicker, right? This whole plan was designed. Everyone says we need to be a lower tax state. Well, you can't get there unless you solve the math problems of what we owe. And by putting that money in now, $1 billion a year extra into education and restructuring our system, $1 billion into the pension debt, you get to a point in 27 years where you're running massive budget surpluses. And when you have massive budget surpluses, you can say, as a society, you can say, gee, what should we do with that now? Should we invest more in higher education? Should we spend more in social services? Or imagine this, should we lower taxes?
Always, I think I know what the popular option would be on that one.
Right.
We're speaking with Democratic State Representative Robert Martwick from Chicago. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on Michigan Avenue. Joining me here in studio is Democratic State Representative Robert Martwick of Chicago. We were talking about the issue of a graduated income tax, something that became a constant theme in the Democratic primary for governor. And we've got a question from Ron. Ron, as always, welcome to the Sunday Spin.
Yes, happy Easter to you, Rick, and your guests. A question to Rep. Illinois continues to lose population. It's various reasons, but taxes has to be one of the reasons. We really feel like we are overtaxed and sick. Now, if you're losing population, there are fewer people paying tax. They have to pay higher taxes. How are we going to I kind of agree with the idea of a progressive tax, but majority states have and the federal government does. But when we just constantly hear, so have you all cut enough? Is the efficiency there? But that is why we're losing people. You just are not going to have enough people paying taxes in the state. So thanks, Rick.
Thank you, Ron.
Well, Ron, I think that our taxation is definitely, you know, I'm sure that factors into it, but as you said, there are various issues that people are leaving the state of Illinois. But we are on a downward spiral in terms of our finances, and I think a lot of people are leaving for that reason as well. And like I said, the idea that we would become a low tax state might encourage people to come back. I would be okay with that concept as well. But again, you have to do the math to get there, and that's what this exercise was. We can't become a low state by wishing that it'll happen. We actually have to do the math to put ourselves on a path towards that. We are the highest debt state in the country, And unless we've got some sort of mathematical plan to deal with that debt, our tax rate will keep growing and growing and growing and growing. And if it is a part of the out-migration, then it will accelerate. So,
well, and I would think, too, is an issue of out-migration is property taxes.
Absolutely.
Perhaps, you know, to a great extent is,
right.
And there you have the variables of property tax rates, you know, by school districts, by whatever. And we are so property tax dependent when it comes to funding education that, you know, one of the keys is to make schools more reliant on state revenues, and that's going to take some money.
Yeah, $3.5 billion is what gets us to our obligation as a state. We're set to do that over the course of the next 10 years. My plan would do that instantly, and then put additional money towards property tax relief, so you'd actually be able to bring down those property taxes and make the state a little bit less regressive in terms of the way that, meaning less of a burden on the middle class, working class, and poor. And of course, those are the people that are leaving the state.
Well, speaking of education, you've been a strong supporter of the concept of having an elected school board in the city of Chicago. But we're not seeing a lot of progress on that front.
No. Last year, I would say that we got closer than we'd ever gotten before in that effort to create an elected school board for the city of Chicago. We passed a bill out of the House with overwhelming numbers, and we passed a bill out of the Senate with overwhelming numbers. The problem was that they were different bills. And we never got around to reconciling those bills so we could put something on the governor's desk. Now, this year, what we've done is we have started a bill in the Senate. So Senator Raul, who is positioned to, he is our nominee, our party's nominee for Attorney General, is stewarding the bill in the Senate. I would imagine, given what he is looking to accomplish in November for himself in his election, I would imagine that this would be a bill that would generate as much positive press as it would generate for him. I think it would be a priority. So I'm hopeful that we get a bill out of the Senate in the form that it was filed in the Senate. If they pass it as such, I know that will pass the House, and then we can put a bill on the governor's desk, hopefully before Election Day, and see where we go.
What do you think Governor Rauner would do with that bill?
You know, he's been all over the board. When it was first filed 3 years ago, he said that not only was an elected school board for Chicago a bad idea, but that he would get rid of all elected school boards across the state, which you could hear the collective downstate Republican caucuses' heads blowing up at that point, because they love their local control. He has changed off that. Now he said he supports an elected school board, but I honestly don't know what he would do. I think the key here for us is that we have the numbers of support. Again, this is not a Chicago issue. It's not a Democratic issue. It had widespread Republican support. We had we had 110 votes in the House to pass this bill. So only 8 people in the House did not vote for this. So if the governor does veto the bill, I believe that there is the support that we would be able to override the veto and make this law.
I mean, one of his contentions is that this would be a union-friendly bill, and we know his feelings towards the public employees' unions.
Yeah, I don't think that that would necessarily be the case. I don't think that we have elected school boards in every school district throughout this state, and I don't know. And a lot of those are very red states and anti-union or red districts. Yeah, so I don't think that we have. I don't think that this bill favors one over the other. I think those are generally convenient excuses for denying the citizens of Chicago a voice in democracy and having a say in how the schools go forward. So, but you know, again, we'll deal with that. We've been able to, this last year, we were able to override a number of his vetoes. I think this one would probably be the easiest veto to override that there would be. So,
well, now you're also the chairman of the Personnel and Pensions Committee. We have the pension debt. We spoke about it earlier.
Yeah.
It's not going away. I don't see any legislation that would alter pension benefits.
No, we can't. I mean, the Supreme Court was crystal clear that unilaterally diminishing pensions is just, we can't, it's a bridge too far. We can't go there. So that is unconstitutional. So
you had, I mean, so we spoke about the graduated tax plan.
Right.
But, is what else is out there?
Well, that's the way I've approached the pension. Given the Supreme Court ruling, it is a debt management problem, right? We owe $130 billion to the pension systems. We've instituted Tier 2, which is a massively, since so every new hire since January 1st, 2011 is on a completely different system with far more austere benefits, and it, in fact, generally speaking, pays for itself. It's not a burden to the taxpayers at all. The employee contributions pay for the entire system. So you're looking at everything going forward for the last 7 years has been completely changed. We just have to figure out how to pay that $130 billion we owe to the old system. And so I've been looking at a number of different measures in the pension committee. We're holding a bunch of hearings designed to do just that, manage the repayment of that debt, reduce the cost of repaying it, to try and save the taxpayers money over the course of the next 27 years. We've looked at using bonding as a tool to refinance the debt, paying less on the interest on the bonds than you actually have to pay on the interest to the debt that's owed to the system. That would be a massive undertaking, but that's the problem, is we have massive debt, so everything we do here would be a massive undertaking. One of the other things we're looking at that I'm most interested in is what I call discounted present cash value buyouts. And what this would do is this would say to retirees, we would give them options where they could sell us some of their benefits in exchange for, so for instance, a tier one retiree walks in with a 3% compounding COLA that is going to last till the day he dies. And what we would do is we would offer him an option where, in exchange for a certain amount of cash, he would instead opt into a lower tier, tier two COLA, which is a 3% simple COLA. And that option is, and again, it's an option, so it would be constitutional because it's entirely up to them. But every employee that exercises it, because it's discounted present cash, that would save us money going forward. So this is a bipartisan initiative. I've worked on this with a number of Republicans, especially Representative Mark Batnick out in Plainfield, and we're looking at a number of different ways of doing this. We're trying to find as many different little options where the more employees, you know, the more options they have, the more likely it is they'll exercise one, and each one of them would be designed to save the system's money over the course of the next 27 years.
Well, we'll keep an eye on what goes on in those hearings and see if some options do arrive, and options that also affect all of us that are paying taxpayers here.
Yeah, and I think the key, too, is that we have to be proactive. Since the first initial attempt at pension reform, which, of course, failed, which was the Senate Bill 1, which unilaterally diminished benefits, there really hasn't been anything proactively designed to try and save the taxpayers' money and save the system's money. That has two effects. Number one, of course, we want our government to be trying to save us money, but we need to show the financial sector that we're out there and we're trying and that we're coming up with proactive plans. That will give them confidence, lower our credit ratings, or improve our credit ratings, lower our debt. Yeah, and that'll give us more options for financing and repayment. So it's about being proactive and creating confidence.
That's Democratic State Representative Robert Martwick of Chicago. Representative, thank you so much for joining me on this Easter Sunday morning.
Thanks, Rick. Happy Easter.
Now, the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin on this April 1st Sunday. Happy Easter. Happy April Fool's Day. In the latest of many cabinet and staff shakeups in this presidency, the most recent to get fired by Twitter was Veterans Affairs Secretary David Shulkin. Shulkin was originally told by Trump's chief of staff that he wouldn't be fired, and certainly not by a tweet, but then John Kelly was forced to call Shulkin back and say, expect to be fired. On MSNBC, Shulkin said he fears that the agency may be dismantled.
I think that there are clear forces that are trying to suggest that a VA system is not necessary, that the private sector can handle all of the care for our veterans. And, you know, we're caring for more than 9 million American veterans, and many of them have very specialized needs. There's research being done by VA that no one else is doing. And this is a system that is absolutely essential, not only for veterans, but for the national security of our country.
Now, the Trump administration also raised eyebrows when it said it would ask people about their citizenship as part of the 2020 federal census. At a press briefing, White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders gave this explanation.
This is a question that's been included in every census since 1965, with the exception of 2010, when it was removed. We've contained this question that's provided data that's necessary for the Department of Justice to protect voters, and specifically to help us better comply with the Voting Rights Act, which is something that is important and a part of this process. And again, this is something that has been part of the census for decades, and something that the Department of Commerce felt strongly needed to be included again.
Has there been any talk of trying to do some type of campaign or some other type of outreach to ensure that immigrants participate, so states like California, for instance, that have large immigrant populations, are counted appropriately?
I'm not aware of those specifics, but I would refer you to the Department of Commerce.
Actually, the citizenship question has not been part of the census since 1950. A voting rights lawyer said that the question has been included on an ongoing American community survey, but not on the full decennial census since the middle of the 20th century. So that was the more correct statement. Now, joining me here in the Allstate Showcase studio is Maria Crizan. She is a co-author of the book Cycle of Segregation, a professor of sociology at the University of Illinois Chicago. Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you for inviting me.
You do a very deep dive into this subject because I think there's pre-established notions that people have of why segregation occurs. And the deep dive, I think, is necessary because it kind of goes to some of these underlying reasons. The issue most people think, well, people just want to be with their own kind of thing.
Right, yeah. I mean, you sort of refer to people have these preconceived notions, and the truth is the scholars and researchers and policymakers have also had these same sort of set of three explanations for segregation that just sort of permeate both the popular discourse but also policymakers
and
the researchers. That's right. So the three, to break the excitement over what those three might be, the three are, like you referred to, one of them is sort of preferences. People think, well, birds of a feather flock together. People just want to live with their quote own kind. So that's one of the core explanations that we've looked at. There's also the explanation of money. Money matters, right? So there continues to be racial inequality in income and wealth in this country. And so people just live where they can afford to live, and that translates, because there's inequality in income, that translates into people living in different neighborhoods. And the third one is that discrimination happens, that despite the fact, and actually April 2018 is a momentous month in the area of fair housing. 50 years ago this month, the Fair Housing Act was passed, which made it illegal to discriminate on the basis of race and ethnicity in renting and buying housing. Well, it turns out, you know, we've made progress. Some of the most blatant forms of discrimination have disappeared, but there's still persistent discrimination, lots of evidence that there still are people get treated differently when they try to rent a house or buy a house. So those are the big three we talk about.
But now when you take the deeper dive, it becomes almost that it's just inculcated in our lifestyles.
Right. All of this is we've sort of in this country to go back a ways, we've really baked segregation into the cities in our country, Chicago being a great example of that. We've created a system that's segregated, and we have to ask ourselves, why does it keep being segregated, even in the face of the expansion of the black middle class, softening white racial attitudes, and reductions in discrimination? And what the sort of shift in your framework is, how do people end up living where they end up living, right? What is the process people go through in order to make a move? And what is it about those processes that ends up funneling us into segregated neighborhoods? And that's really the point of our book. We're sort of saying, let's change the conversation. Let's expand the conversation, right? The big three still matter, but let's shift and ask, how do you end up living where you end up living? What shapes the information that you draw, and what shapes the process that you go through when you're making a search? And we talk about the social factors that shape that. So if you just think yourself about the last time you made a move, what did you do, right? You probably asked your friends and family, well, what's a good place to live? Where should I go? Right? So those social networks inform your search process in lots of direct and indirect ways.
Go ahead.
Elaborate on that. So the direct way might be, oh, yeah, so I was just driving down the street and I saw a house for sale down the street from my house. Maybe you want to buy that house, right? So there's a very direct impact of social networks. There's also another direct impact of social networks, that I want to live by my friends and family, want to see them, right? I mean, there are some people who don't want to live by their friends and family, but that also creates a sort of consideration set of neighborhoods for people. But there's also indirect ways that social networks matter, even when you're not looking for a place to live, right? As we live our lives and as we interact with people, we're gathering information about our metro area, about the Chicago area. We're learning about, you know, just a chance comment at the over the water cooler at work. Somebody says, oh, yeah, I was just out in, pick a name of a city, with my kids, and it looks really nice out there, right? We're gathering information all the time. It's the stuff of living in a city about places, and we're learning what places are the good places, what are the bad places. Or I know that my boss grew up in a particular city, and I know my boss is white and middle class and Catholic, so it's probably a community that's white, middle class, and Catholic, right? So we're always making these inferences about communities based on our social networks and our exposure to different people. So where segregation comes in, then, is that we know that those social networks are racially segregated often, on average. People tend to have social networks that are comprised of, especially white people, of individuals who are white. African Americans' social networks tend to have more African Americans than other groups, right? Same with Latinos. So if that information that's coming to you is racially circumscribed, then the moves that come out of that information process are sort of, you're funneled in a direction that is going to perpetuate segregation.
So it's almost like we're each in our own silo, kind of, mm-hmm. that silo builds walls.
Right. Builds walls, and it funnels us into making moves because the information that we're gathering and the perceptions that we're gathering are racialized. We end up making moves, and those moves in the aggregate across a city, right, thousands of people moving every year, just continues to perpetuate. That's where the perpetuation comes from. Because we're segregated residentially, right, that's one factor of why we have segregated social networks. So those segregated social networks are feeding information about where my next move is, which make
a reinforcement.
Reinforcement, exactly.
We're speaking with Maria Crazen. She is professor of sociology at University of Illinois Chicago, and she's co-author of the book Cycle of Segregation. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in historic Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue. Joining me here in the studio is Maria Creason. She's professor of sociology at the University of Illinois Chicago and co-author of the book Cycle of Segregation, which examines everyday social processes that shape residential stratification that really is the segregation here. So we talk about how we have, you know, we have our same social networks of like-minded people that serve as a reinforcement technique, but that still keeps everything segregated. How do we end the cycle of segregation?
Sure. Yeah, it's a great question. I wish I knew the one answer that we could just snap our fingers and have it taken care of, but obviously that's not the case. But I think the idea of our, part of the argument in our book is that instead of focusing on these big three explanations of economics, preferences, and discrimination, again, we have to work on those three, and we certainly have to continue to enforce the Fair Housing Act and discrimination. But we want to, by focusing on how people search for places to live, that really opens up some policy levers that were kind of not on our radar screens prior to this. And it says, how do we intervene in the search process? A search process that's informed by social networks and that's informed by lived experiences. How do we intervene to provide, for example, information and to reshape people's perceptions about communities that have been, prior to this, really shaped by these sort of racially circumscribed experiences? So how do you, for example, if we understand that one of the things that's going on is that people have racial blind spots, people know more about communities that are communities that are segregated, comprised of their racial group, how do you have public PR campaigns? You know, communities could have campaigns and PR campaigns to reach out to individuals who are, you know, not the sort of person they expect to come and try to move into their
community. You mean a diversity outreach kind of program?
Right, right. Or just even creating you know, imagery that is racially diverse, that says all people are welcome here, right? So one of the things that we didn't talk about much is that people's perceptions, they use shortcuts. They don't do detailed research like, you know, get online.
Your deep dive.
Find everything there is to know about communities. People don't know everything, and they use shortcuts. We call them heuristics, right? They're shortcuts. I know one thing about a place, and I can fill in the blank on all the other characteristics. So for many white people in particular, if I know one thing about a community, if I know that it's got a high percentage of African Americans, they often will fill in the blank and say it's also must be bad schools, high crime, property values won't increase, right? For African Americans, they may know...
Uninformed,
exactly. And so how do we intervene? We can create information campaigns and easy to access information about communities to try to disrupt that process of the heuristic, right? Interrupt the assumptions that people make about communities.
But as you said, this is, in a way, it is intervening in that process. And so...
I mean, it's not an aggressive intervention.
No, right? Understood.
So it's not, nobody's telling anybody where to move, but it's, you know, basically we're saying we have constructed this situation and we need to break down some of these perceptions, both in reality and in just the perception.
But it would seem to me difficult to do that because that's not going to be a natural tendency of
right.
people.
Right, exactly, exactly. It has to be intentional. I mean, like I have said, you know, it took us decades and decades of intentional actions. We haven't talked about this yet. The reason we have segregation is not some unknowable thing, and it's not some accident. It's not natural, right? There are lots of actors at the state, the federal, and the local level that have created segregation. There's Richard Rothstein's book, The Color of Law, put a pitch out there for that, really lays out the case that this was intentional. We created segregation intentionally. So we have to be just as intentional to undo this segregation. We have to have programs. We have to commit to undoing this because we got ourselves into this through very intentional actions at all levels of government. All levels of government
and
need to
government,
be intentional.
Government helped build the walls. Government helped.
Absolutely, I mean, helped build.
Look at how the interstate highway system
correct.
Was used to basically segregate
yes,
communities.
Yes, and mortgage lending, redlining, you know, the list goes on. Public housing sites and segregated public housing, it just, the disinvestment in communities once you created the highways to get people out of the city. Yeah, there's just, I mean, it's just decades and decades of action. So we need to start having that same intentionality about undoing some of this.
And, so, and you're saying it should be government.
I
mean,
well, I think that's the thing about our book is that we really highlight how at many different levels. I mean, it's at the individual level. You ask yourself, if you care about this issue, how am I going to do my next housing search, right? But it can go up to communities that care about this and care about more equity and more integration that decide we're going to do something about this. We're going to reach out to communities that normally don't come to our doorsteps.
Do you think communities care about
I think
that?
There are communities that care, and I think there are people that care.
There are some.
Mm-hmm.
But is this something that's necessary?
Right. I mean, I think there's carrots and sticks. I mean, I think that, yeah, some communities can be, well, not to get too far in the weeds of policy, but the end of the Obama administration, they passed new rules about the Fair Housing Act that had been not as aggressively pursued. And but mostly the Fair Housing Act has been about enforcing anti-discrimination, right? But there's something called Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing, which is also part of the Fair Housing
Act. That's the proactive.
That's the more proactive, right? So there are new rules for communities that were guidelines to communities really thinking about what are the barriers to integration in my community and how can we undo these. And we think that our book offers some ideas about this for communities. Now, the Trump administration has paused the implementation of those rules, but I think this is something that communities around the country and cities recognize, that segregation is a problem for all of us. It's costing all of us, and we need to figure out ways. So yes, the government is involved, but you know, individuals, local governments can be involved, neighborhood groups can be involved. You can go up and down the.
And you don't necessarily need the rules.
The
proactive rules that these groups, communities, whatever, can act on their own.
They can act on their own. I mean, I think the rules. I think they need to implement the rules, but I also think that there are openings and there are communities around the country that are pursuing it nevertheless.
Now, you have an event coming up on Wednesday, Disrupting the Cycle of Segregation, at John Marshall Law School. I believe that's from 9:30 to 11:30 a.m. And do you know where they can get more information about this event? Actually, I know it's on Eventbrite. You can get tickets are free there. And if you just search for
Disrupting the Cycle of Segregation, yep.
And you'll be there with your
my co-author, Kyle Crowder, from the University of Washington, yep.
And also, where can they get the book? I think it's on Amazon.
It is on Amazon. You can go to the publisher, Russell Sage Foundation, and maybe some local bookstores.
And just and again, search for Cycle of Segregation.
Yes.
Maria Creason, thank you so much for joining me this morning. It's a deep dive, but it's one that makes you think in ways that you're not used to thinking. And I think that's always an important thing for all of us to learn how new ways of thinking and new ideas. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome to April. April 1st, in a brisk day in downtown Chicago, just out on the Storm Center patio where the wind is keeping things a bit chilly despite all the sunshine out there. And I read from Mr. Skilling that we're supposed to be expecting below normal temperatures for almost the first half of this month of April. So,
and for the sake of accuracy, may I say that the winds are northwest at 7 miles an hour, gusting to 10. So that's why it was a little brisk on the Storm Center patio.
Yes, indeed. And it's nothing like starting April with a wind chill, you know?
Yeah, how about that?
Yeah.
No fooling.
There ain't no, yeah, we're the fools for being out in it. That's the deal. Well, thank you, Dave. Just a political note here that last night a filing with the State Board of Elections that Democratic gubernatorial nominee J.B. Pritzker has put another $7 million of his own money into his campaign for governor. That now brings the total amount that the billionaire heir of the Hyatt Hotel fortune has put into his campaign, already a record, $76.5 million that he has put into his campaign as he now runs for the general election against Republican Governor Bruce Rauner. Last Tuesday night, I had the privilege of moderating a discussion at Aurora University with two justices in the Illinois Supreme Court, Justice Ann Burke and Justice Rita Garman. The subject was about women in leadership, and I asked Justice Garman, who is from Danville, about how she got into the law, and then I asked the same question from Justice Burke. They both found the law in very different ways. Let's start with Justice Garman.
I knew from an early age that I wanted to be a lawyer. Why? I have no idea.
TV?
TV was a new thing back in the day. But I just thought it was a great profession. I thought it offered a great number of choices, what you could do. You could, be a transactional lawyer. You could work for a corporation. You could work in education. I couldn't have dreamed I would ever ended up where I am. Because when I went to college and then went to law school, that was in the 60s. And people just women did not go to law school.
Well, I was going to say, so, and then Iowa has a noted law school program.
Yes.
How many women?
Five women and 160 men. And when I went to law school, I said I was going to law school, people said to me, why does a nice girl like you want to do something like that? True, they do. And they said, well, why don't you get married and send your husband to law school? And I said, because I want to go to law school. He can go too, but I want to go. And so I went to law school. And I got to law school, and I encountered some of the professors that said, what are you doing here? You're taking up a seat a man could have. You'll never practice law. You're not really serious. You're here to catch a husband. I had already caught him, but that was But at any rate, they were just incredible. So I went through law school as, one of very, very few women. And then I got out and I found out they weren't very accepting of women in the practice of law. I had potential job interviews where they said things to me like, well, what would we do with you? No one wants to talk to a woman. Can you type? Can you make coffee?
Clerical work.
Yes. We don't need a clerk, or we can't afford that. And so I wanted to be a lawyer, but here I was a lawyer, and I couldn't find a job when I got out of law school. So I actually found my first job by luck, because my husband and I had moved to Danville, where he was with a law firm, and I was looking for a job, encountering all these barriers. People would say to me, well, how can you be a lawyer? Your husband's a lawyer. And then they would say, well, wouldn't you go home and talk to your husband about the cases? And I said, well, not any more than he's going to come home and talk to me about his cases. But it was just a time when people, they just couldn't understand a woman in that profession. So in looking around for a job, I lucked out, because the legal aid director in Danville, it was a one-person office, got into a disagreement with the board, and he walked out. And they didn't have anybody, and they were in danger of closing. And the chairman of the legal aid board called me up and said, I'd been in Danville about 2 months at that point, and he said, well, would you come down and keep the doors of the legal aid office open? And I said, well, what do I know about running a law office? I just got out of law school. He said, well, if you'll come down there, we'll help you if you get into anything you don't know how to do, or how to handle it. So I went to the legal aid office, and I began the practice of law, and did it like you learn to ride a bike. You just do it. And I found that the people that came to legal aid certainly didn't care that I was a woman. They certainly didn't care that I was young. They were just delighted to have somebody to talk to and to help them and to work through
and
their
problems. And be an advocate.
And be an advocate for them. So that's how I started. And as I practiced law, I think I gained credibility with the bench and bar. And after about 6 months of legal aid, it didn't close. And one day the state's attorney came into the legal aid office and said, I'd like you to come to the state's attorney's office to handle the family cases. And that's how many women integrated into the practice of law. You know, do the juveniles, non-supports, parentage cases, and that sort of thing. And that was a permanent job. So I went to the state's attorney's office. I hadn't even been able to get in the door of the state's attorney's office for an interview when I got there, because they told me they weren't hiring, and they weren't hiring women. So that was how that all came about. So you just keep your head down and keep on going.
Now, Justice Burke, you came to the law later in life. You started as a teacher. You helped children with disabilities. You worked for the Chicago Park District, and you founded the Special Olympics. And that's all great achievements in their own right. So then, what brought you to the law?
Well, first of all, I was a college dropout in 1963. The school that I went to actually is a sister school of Aurora. I went to George Williams College when it was in Hyde Park and emerged in what moved to Downers Grove. So in 1962, I went to your college to be a phys ed teacher, and I dropped out. I didn't go back to college until I was married and had three children. So that was in the 70s. But it was my husband who suggested that I go back and get my teaching degree. He kind of gave me a guilty complex because he said, they don't have a college degree, and if something happens to me, what are you going to do? So he encouraged me to go back to college with three little kids, not the way to do it, but I did, and I went to DePaul University School of Learning. We had our fourth child, and he started asking me about, you know, the program that I was teaching with kids with mental disabilities. I had all this experience, and he started saying to me, you know, you'd be a better advocate for people with disabilities and the more vulnerable, that you're passionate. Why don't you become a lawyer? But he forgot about the fact that I've been a C student or less my whole life. All through grammar school, all through high school, and it was the wonder that I went to George Williams College that the professor, during a research project he had, how many basketball people you could do under hypnosis and how many you could do without being hypnotized. I did more under hypnosis, by the way. But the exercise he gave us was under hypnosis. Stand in the front of the chalkboard, write your name, your age, age 18, my name, and went all the way down to 5. And when I was awake, I had started writing my name right to left. It was all backwards. And he told me I had a perceptual handicap. So that was the first time I realized why I was a bad student. I had to read every twice, I couldn't do math, I couldn't transpose numbers. So dropping out of college was actually a good thing, because if I had finished another year in science, I would have flunked out of college. But when I did go back, I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I did really well, and then I decided, through his suggestion, to take a law school under his exam. I did okay. So when I entered law school at IIT Kent, there were about 20% of women who were in my class, which was interesting. But they were retreads like myself, women who had other careers, other areas, who went back to school. So we were kind of off to the side. There were some younger students. So that 20% of my class, so I didn't graduate from law school until I was over 40.
We'll have more of my conversation with Illinois Supreme Court Justices Ann Burke and Rita Garman. Good Sunday morning, April 1st Sunday morning. I'm Rick Pearson. This is your Sunday Spin. As I said earlier last week, I had the privilege of moderating a discussion at Aurora University with Illinois Supreme Court Justices Ann Burke and Rita Garman about women in leadership. And in our conversation, I also brought up the renewed rise of the women's movement in the United States, as well as the hashtag MeToo movement. So I asked the Supreme Court Justices, did you ever have a MeToo moment? Here's Justice Ann Burke, followed by Justice Rita Garman.
I don't really Me Too moment, if that's what you want to call it now, an aggressive situation. I was able to deflect it, walk away from it, and tell whoever it was, lighten up, you know, like get out of here, or whatever it was. I never really did, but I think those Me Too moments do occur in the workplace, and they have, for me, as even a, you know, a more mature woman in the law practice, where, you know, they think they could be a little more familiar, and I just kind of blare and walk away, you know. So, but I haven't really had the kind of Me Too moments that I've read about and heard about myself.
I've not had any that go to the level of the some of what
the
I've
most
read
notorious.
About. The most notorious. But I certainly did have some experiences where I thought conduct was inappropriate, and I called the person on it immediately and deflected it and got away from that, you know, from that situation. No, does that sort of thing exist? I hear about that from, you know, women in the throughout society, but from women in the practice, I do hear about it.
And here again, another issue that seems to be part of the evolution and how, I mean, I remember my first year covering Springfield was 1982, and that was the year of the Equal Rights Amendment. And Illinois was one of the last states with the pressure on to adopt it, which it did not do. But we have this great resurgence in women's rights, and I'm just curious what your view is of now, you know, as part of this evolution from where you came from.
Well, you know, personally, I think it's long overdue. I don't think that I don't think you should have to put up with that kind of conduct. That's nonsense. And I do believe that for generations, it's not been considered very important. Maybe because women weren't, you know, was involving women, and people thought that's the way you should treat women. Hopefully, we're past that.
Justice Burke.
Well, just like Justice Garmon said about her history, she wasn't treated equally. She took the bar exam and wanted to get a job, and she wasn't able to get the kind of job she thought she should be able to get. I mean, and that is in our world in the present time, just like Justice Smith-Murrow. She was told she couldn't argue in the Illinois Supreme Court. She worked on the case, she tried the case, she should be able to do it and get equal pay, and that hasn't happened. And I think that that's the kind of thing that we have to rise up for. The first woman lawyer in Illinois was Myra Bradwell. She applied for to take the bar, you know, many years ago, but the Illinois Supreme Court, our male colleagues that went ahead before us, told her she could not be a lawyer in Illinois because she was a married woman. In other words, she was chattel.
When women were chattel for hundreds of years.
It was a very fascinating discussion with Justices Ann Burke and Rita Garmon, and just about kind of the history of their lives, their professional lives at a time when women weren't really accepted into the legal profession like other professions, but also just as well a great discussion about the evolution of the law as they've seen it in regards to women's rights. And I want to thank Aurora University for inviting me out there to host that discussion. It's among several that I've done with the university, part of their Town Square series. But it was just even though it's their Your Honors, it was my honor to be part of that conversation.